Andrew Winston, thanks so much for joining us here on CSR Wire.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great. Now, Andrew, I'd love for you to pick your favorite example from the book Green Recovery that really illustrates your point the best. What's something that people can wrap their heads around really easily that they can walk away from this conversation with a sense of what the green wave is and how it's operating in the real world?
Well, I'll give one little example there that I can point to that's the great example of companies saving money. Companies in their fleets, their trucking and distribution have gotten much more efficient. And this is stuff that doesn't seem very sexy or exciting. But Walmart and others have started putting in these auxiliary power units, these things that allow truckers to turn off their engines and stop idling so they can heat or cool the cab while they're resting or sleeping or doing whatever. This has improved the fleet efficiency for Walmart 8%. 8% in total fleet efficiency just by adding these power units that provide a little bit of power to the truckers. This kind of thing done nationally, just that one change would reduce our energy use in the country, you know, a significant chunk, probably 0.5%, because idling is such a huge problem. So there's one sort of fun, you know, little example that doesn't seem very exciting but adds up. But my favorite story in the book is actually one of innovation from a company called Tennant in Minneapolis. They make a floor cleaning machine. It's a sleepy industry. They're a 130-year-old company. And the way these machines have always worked is that you push a big machine around, like a mall or a hard floor, and there's chemicals and water in the machine, and they go on the floor and they scrub, and you pick up the chemicals and the dirt and the water. And they developed a machine that uses just tap water with a fairly simple technology that ionizes the water and it oxygenates it, and that water hits the floor, and that picks up dirt in many ways better than the mix of soap, chemicals, and water. It dries faster. It requires no training on how to use toxic chemicals because there are none. It's purely tap water. This is almost beyond disruptive. I mean, this is a perfect example of taking an industry and really shaking it up, because all those companies that make the chemicals that go into cleaning machines are now being challenged with a competitor that says, we don't even need your product. We can do this with water. And it's a story of innovation. It's a story of culture at the company. They set a new standard that they would be an environmental cleaning company and just said, go find solutions. And the R&D guys were in Japan and saw that a hospital was cleansing wounds with this ionized water. They had been doing it for 30 years. And they said, why can't we do that on the floor? And so they took something from a totally different place and applied it to an environmental challenge. And it's the fastest growing product in their history, and they're changing the industry. And to me, that's an incredible story of innovation, and that will help this company ride out the recession and ride out the next one. It takes that kind of innovation. But no one seems to hear this Tennant story, and I find it stunning. I mean, when I was speaking at an industry event for the cleaning industry, you know, trade show, when they were launching this, and so this was almost 2 years ago, and they were launching sort of the prototype, and I just kept saying, well, wait a minute, it just uses water? Like, because it didn't seem like it was possible. And I talked to the guys that were their test customers, and you know, it works, and they were happier with it, you know. And it's you know, it's a very similar story in a way to the Prius. It costs a little bit more, but you know, you actually save money within like a year on not having to buy chemicals, you know. But it's also, I mean, it's a really interesting story. If it's so disruptive that it's not even, I think, growing as fast as it could, because people are, you know, they're skeptical. There's inertia, and they're not sure. They think, well, that can't work. You know, so it's growing fast, but not nearly as fast as it probably should.
Yeah, it's such an interesting effect that you're talking about that I've seen in so many places, where there's this undue skepticism for anything that smacks of being environmentally beneficial, or even socially beneficial,
right,
for that matter,
right,
that somehow there's got to be something wrong with it, instead of just seeing it as a no-brainer, common sense issue.
Right. Instead of just being, wow, that's really innovative. I mean, it's funny, we'll accept that, you know, a Lunchables pack is an innovative consumer product and go, yeah, I never thought to pack, you know, everything in a little plastic wrap for my kid before, instead of just making them a sandwich. But, you know, we'll accept some consumer product innovation, but something like this, like, well, that can't work. You know, it's like, it's very funny. I mean, think about, there was skepticism about the hybrid cars, you know, for a long time. And it's not totally unwarranted. I mean, green products sucked for a long time. And they were pitched as, but they're good for the world, you know. You know, the best green products are the ones, I mean, if you read the Tennant materials, on their machine. I mean, it's not super greeny, you know. I think they're pitching some of the other benefits, like there's less slippage, it dries faster, you don't have to train people. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that the buyers love. And I think that's true of most green stuff. You got to pitch it on lots of things. The Prius is fun to drive. It's a Motor Trend Car of the Year. It's, you know, it's a great technology. So we'll see. We'll see. But I agree with you. We need a completely different system. And I think, you know, it's so easy because I've had some people go, oh, the Get Lean stuff, we've heard that. I'm like, yeah, of course we have. But if everyone were doing it, we wouldn't need to keep saying it and keep writing about it. Like, I feel ridiculous having to write, you should change your lighting to something that saves you 75% of energy and cost.
Right.
But we have to keep saying it
right. Because
people think the lighting sucks. I mean, I always love that argument about, well, the green product won't sell and people don't want it. It's like, well, we create demand all the time. Their whole job, their whole existence in consumer products, CPG, and the agencies for decades has basically been creating demands.
That's right.
I mean, that's what
they do.
That
don't exist. Exactly. And so we could apply that same thing. It's like Walmart is, now that they're applying their muscle towards sustainability, it's like all of a sudden that muscle is cool, you know? It's like...
Right, exactly. I think we're definitely starting to reach that real tipping point in green where... It's and I do believe this, there is no going back, and this is the message in all my talks and all of my writing basically is this is not optional anymore. And
right.
So one of the themes throughout the book is, you know, climate change is a political and business reality now. It doesn't matter what you think about the science. I say that in numerous places, and I get so much still debate about that.
Yeah.
Saying something to me that seems like tautological. Or it's just true. I'm just telling you, 180 countries are about to regulate this carbon. And companies like Walmart, GE, everybody else are pushing to reduce emissions. They're not going away. I mean, they see it as lowering costs. And by the way, carbon's going to get expensive. So, you know, I told one audience, I said, if you have carbon somewhere in your value chain, which means everyone, your cost structure is going to change.
Right.
So how could you not be ready for that? And I had a guy asking me, like, you're making political statements, which I categorically do not in my talks. I mean, I say up front, this is not a political issue. I just say it's a political reality. Which is a totally different statement. You know, it's not like you have to be a Democrat to agree with this. But people are so emotional about this issue, and so they're just holding on to something. They're holding on to some view of the world that I don't really get. You know, all we're doing is spewing money out the smokestack. So what is it we're doing this for? Like, why are we reliant on fossil fuels?
Yeah. Well, that and to get people to change is a huge. I mean, there's a whole sort of behavioral aspect or psychological, and you address it in the book in talking about, you know, change, you know, turning off lights. I mean, that,
yeah.
I think that's the basic example. But when you point to the climate change issue, I think people are clinging fast to their denial because to recognize that climate change is real is. It would require them to have a whole psychological shift and also to acknowledge their own sort of place in the system that creates
right.
this, you know?
And, right, and so that what they I, have a role, what they I, contributed.
It, well, yeah, and I try and take it out of that. Like, I'm not personally responsible for the fact that we have a system that's predicated on fossil fuels.
Right.
And I don't blame the past for creating that. It makes total sense that we would have done that, but now that we've got the data that says that that's a problem— We need to let go of our sort of emotional attachment to fossil fuels and say, you know, how do we save ourselves? You know, how do we save our asses? So,
well, it's there's an old phrase. Where is that? I always can't remember where I have this somewhere. But there's an old rabbinical saying from very long ago, hundreds of years ago. That's something like it's not entirely your problem, but you're not free from responsibility.
Yes.
There's something to that effect. I don't have the right words. It's better in the actual wording. But, you know, basically, like, yeah, I mean, we're one of 7 billion people. So, of course, you know, it's not your fault, but that doesn't make you free from responsibility. I was speaking at a coal company, and someone came up and said, and it was so telling. He said, I know we're not, you know, humans are not responsible. And I was like, okay. And then he said something like, I just know that we drive doesn't matter. And I was like, I thought that's the moment where he said I, that's actually what he meant. He just couldn't believe that what he personally drove would cause such a big problem.
Yep.
And I felt like saying, what I thought about for a while after that was like, you know, I hear you, and it's painful, but I also just wanted to say grow up. Because what you're describing is the difference between a child and an adult. I mean, a child says, my kids all the time, I'm not going to clean that up. You know, like, I don't care if I made it. It's like, grow up. You're an adult. The messes we make, we have to do something about. And we are responsible. So it's just, I find the discussion just, it's ridiculous. We're children. And this country is incredibly childish. You know, it's, we just don't take responsibility very well.
Yeah. Well, there's people who would say, and I believe this, that, you know, culturally we are at an adolescent developmental phase. I mean, it maps perfectly onto human development. And the question is, you know, are we going to collectively take that next step into young adulthood where we start to take responsibility for our actions? And I, you know, time will tell what the answer to that one is. Well, Andrew Winston, author of Green Recovery, thanks so much for speaking with us here on CSR Wire.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much.